So what a beloved colleague was researching himself and understood his greatest difficulty to be that he felt himself to be too much and not enough. A paradox that I think is at the heart of many, many people. Not enough that we feel crippled by insecurities, and often too much that we can't help ourselves but talk and vaunt our opinions and capacities, when what's really happening is crippling doubt. That paradox of human existence, though not true for all of us, many do reach a state of true, comfortable, appropriate humility and confidence. Those challenges of bringing those two aspects together, ambition and crippling insecurity, is a central quest of many, if not all, lives. And illustrated somewhat parabolically, in parable, in this week's parasha. So Moses is instructed to present marvels and sort of mini miracles, maybe parlor tricks, one might even say, to Pharaoh, to convince Pharaoh of his capacity and his divine mission, which led me to believe they were accepted as such a natural course of interaction at the court, so to speak, that it led me to believe that maybe in ancient times this idea of producing marvels, to use one translation, was a typical act, was a way that emissaries came to each other, was a way that sort of a bona fides, that one illustrated one's capacity by doing a magic trick. Here's my favorite, right? Watch these. I've got two fingers here. Dump it. That's the only magic trick I know. But also I can do this. But the too much side comes from the Egyptian magicians, and it's repeatedly described that there are Egyptian magicians doing their magics. Much in the same way that Balaam, his prophecy is never questioned, much in the same way that other divine entities of other nations, their true existence is never questioned. So whether these were, in our words, parlor tricks, or whether prophecy is a form of schizophrenia, one could not say, but or perhaps an epileptic issue. No, I mean, there are epileptic issues where one has visions. Which is to say that their magic is not questioned, that it is a real thing, that other peoples have magic and miracle, and they're qualitatively different, but not different in existence. So that the Egyptian magicians are likewise able to destroy the waters of the Nile. The Egyptian magicians are likewise able to replicate the plague of frogs. But the transition becomes that they can't replicate the lice. And then the further transition is that they are afflicted by the boils, rather the skin boils, rather than being able to replicate them on others. So that, along with the fact that they are differentiated, that the plagues are differentiated, that Israelites in Goshen are spared from many plagues, and in Midrash that's exemplified even further. Parenthetically, how did slaves live in a different part of the nation? Question for thought that I had this week. That they are secluded in a different part, a safe sort of haven in the nation, yet they are somehow also enslaved to every other people. Question that I've never seen an answer to. So there is a reality to the Egyptian magicians and their magic, but a qualitative difference. And says the sage Sforno, writing in Italy some, I think, 300 or 400 years ago, even Pharaoh noticed that it was not the same kind of magic. That Moses and Aaron did tricks, did marvels, that he had seen others replicated, but there was something qualitatively different. The Egyptian magician's magic was flashy, but not morally pure, one might say. They're called kashafim. The Talmud notices in Sanhedrin, Rabbi Yochanan says, why is this a title for them? And he makes a pun saying that title means that they lessen, they diminish God's agency. They diminish the divine potencies. I think everyone knows someone who is capable of entering a conversation only with snark and irony and only withdrawing from the conversation rather than being a positive influence on the interaction. They are comfortable in their grandeur with sarcasm, but less so with true vulnerability. So they take away from the community, the social interaction, the intercourse, rather than adding to it. I think that's the nature of the magicians. The sense we get in the early plagues that they are capable of replicating is that they can make things worse, but not better. Oznaim LeTorah, another collection of Midrash, says they were wise in the ways of worsening plagues, but not in solving them. Too big and yet not enough. So I thought about this, and I think the point, the upshot, the moral of this parable, this fable, is that if your agency is not for uplift, it's pretty thin. If your agency is only to demonstrate your own arrogance and potency, it wears thin and does not endure. It eventually will run out of effective power. So what's the answer? How does one balance an appropriate humility with the ultimate senses of insecurity and imposterhood and false grandeur that everyone carries within them? There is the Kabbalistic idea of tzimtzum, that even God has to withdraw God's self to make room for others. That the way of creation was not that God filled up every available space, but that God pulled back. There's a song the kids sing in preschool and at KJDS. Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. But I don't know why I started singing it this way. It was sort of a misunderstanding. I say nearly everywhere. Obviously, theologically deeply inappropriate to sing it that way. But that is what Tzimtzum sort of indicated, that God withdrew from certain spheres, especially spheres of human interaction, especially spheres of the created world developing, to make room for that developing, to make room for the processes of evolution by natural selection, to make room for the distortions of the Big Bang. And as I've said before, that Steve Martin idea of getting small is very intrinsic to becoming a holy and spiritual person. Another thing, as I mentioned about that colleague that came up at the conference, was this repeated question of what is spirituality? That like a word like leadership or arrogance or many other words, we don't share a common definition. I've spoken about this in other cases. Spirituality seems one of those awkward words where everyone means something different. And it's certainly admittedly a word I struggle with. I don't really know what we mean when we say spirituality. But a colleague has said something really insightful. He thinks of it as dvekut, which is largely a Hasidic idea of cleaving, of clinging to God. And he understands that to mean sort of an attunement to the ways of the world, a flow state, as the psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi said. The idea of being in flow and in unison and alert to the goings on of the world. And to do that, there requires a certain amount of tzimtzum, of making ourselves small and simple and quiet and even still. So going back to the magicians, why couldn't they recreate the lice? Do you know? You give that a look like. Too small. You can't use ill magic on something smaller than a grain of rice. Did you know that? I didn't. It's a well-known fact that magic only works on, magic doesn't work on a quantum scale, basically, is the issue. It's different. There's Newtonian magic and quantum magic, and they can only do Newtonian magic to satisfy our scientists. That's what Rashi notes about their inability to reproduce lice, and I think that speaks to their grandeur. Again, the grandeur, the arrogance, the capacity to inflate, to make conversations more precarious, but not to diminish oneself such that others can speak, such that experiences can be shared, such to promote shared vulnerability. So in the plague of the hail, we're told seemingly strange detail, which grains were afflicted by the hail and which weren't. So I think it's the emmer and the barley were not hit by the hail because they are planted later, which seems like a detail only in place to tell you what season it happened. They were afilut, or afilot. They were pliant. They were still malleable, so they were knocked over and ruined by the hail. They were still soft. They hadn't gotten to their full growth. So the Talmud says that a person should always be as pliant as a reed and never as unyielding as the cedar. The aspiration I've thought always is suppleness. I don't know about you, but a thing I notice about myself if I'm overtired is I get rigid. I lose my suppleness. And I don't know if that's common, but there are many experiences in life, stress, distress, anxiety, that I think the first thing we lose is our suppleness, our gemishiyut, to use the Hebrew word, our softness, our ability to compromise, our ability to move freely, our ability to be poetic and balletic. So that's another piece of tzimtzum. And then I think the most obvious place that we get sort of crushed by our own ego is in breath. We become restricted and constricted. In fact, Mitzrayim, the Hebrew word for Egypt, means the straits, the narrow place, which I was pondering this week. It, also using Ye'or, the Nile, as a channel, I think what they were going with when they described the nation of Egypt as narrow was probably that the whole nation was the area settled around the Nile. It was not a broad nation, it was a narrow nation. I mean, now, if you think about the modern Egyptian borders, that's not true, but I suspect the Egyptian empire was heavily concentrated in the Nile and especially the Delta. Those are the places that would support populations. That's my guess of how the word Mitzrayim develops, but it's not so important. So very early in the parsha, Moses is trying to address with God how he's going to gather the people up, how he's going to win their confidence. And he says to them, they don't shamu, they don't heed my call, they will not heed the call because they are mikotzer ruach. Their breath is shortened. They are, we often use gasping for breath. There's another word that's in JPS. So shameless plug, I've been doing meditations for Insight Timer, and the last one I did was on this very idea of expanding one's breath, which seems to be elsewhere, I've acknowledged a part of Shabbat is to allow us to breathe more deeply and expansively. I think making space for others and not being too much and at the same time not enough is in part both literally and metaphorically about breathing deeply, breathing with ease, living a life of suppleness and ease and smallness, literally and metaphorically. God's voice is called the small, still voice in later prophecies. That we make ourselves quiet and simple and easy. So I'll leave you with a midrash cited in this week's parasha. Not an immediate relation to any particular verse. It focuses on Proverbs in this parasha. But the midrash notes that Proverbs says, "A fool spends all his spirit, but a wise man will still him at last." The fool, says the Midrash, when one contends with their fellows, spends up all their words at once, while a wise man holds them in and discomfits the fool in the end. I remember at Arnold's funeral being overwhelmed by the sense of a leader that spoke very little. And looking at Gilya, I think about your capacity to radiates effective leadership with very few words. It's a struggle, I'll be candid and transparent, I have, and I know many people have, to hold back. That real power comes not from vaunting oneself and expanding oneself, but real power comes from the ability to make space for others through vulnerability and silence.